No. Twice it's been other fellas, but I don't remember their names. Usually it's Bucky. Then sometimes Alan might come over by himself later for supper. Not always. We don't see that much of him when he's here, but we guess he just finds his old hometown restful.
Yes, of course. How long has he been doing this?
Visiting us regularly? Since he became the big cheese out at that airplane company. I guess business brings him east more now.
The last 6 or 7 years?
I'd say the last 4 years. We saw him hardly at all when he was first married, which is apt to be the way.
Why do you say he flies too much?
Flying's dangerous, son, especially in a private jet. Anything could go wrong.
You mean he could get hurt?
He could get killed. I haven't heard they're making airplanes out of rubber yet. He's already been in one air crash, you know, two in fact, overseas.
I know. You didn't mind his boxing, though, when he was a kid.
Who says we didn't?
You did mind?
We did about everything we could think of to make him stop. Every afternoon down there in the cellar beating the beeswax out of the punching bags, whomp, 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 till supper time. There was a period when he was out fighting 2 nights a week. No one's brain can stand that. I was sure his brain was going to run out his ears. Enough ran out his nose.
Why didn't you stop him from boxing, then?
If you ever have a son, you'll find out that when he gets to be 14 or 15, there's some things you can't tell him not to do. The more you tell them not to smash their heads against the wall, the more they insist upon doing it. They never believe they're going to need things like brains later on in life.
Then why didn't he go on to the Nationals?
You can't figure the answer to that question?
No, sir.
Girls, son. Girls. No matter how much time 15-year-old boys spend thrashing around in the basement, sooner or later they notice girls. And that's the end of their thrashing around in the basement. The boxing gloves were hung up and out came the pocket comb. I admit, though, it took us a while to figure it out. He had sure wanted to go to the Nationals and he was very, very good at outboxing people. Suddenly, before the Nationals, the house stopped shaking, the whumping ceased. We thought he was sick. The night he told us he was not going to the Nationals was about the happiest night of our lives. The punching bags are still hanging in our basement. Never touched them since. They need a rest after the beating they took. Then, of course, Alan took to flying airplanes. Sons just don't know how to keep their parents relaxed. I'm sure you weren't a bit kinder to your parents, Mr. James.
I guess not. Maybe it's just as well your son and daughter-in-law don't have a child.
Oh, no. Bringing up kids is not the same as eating cream chicken, but you shouldn't miss it.
Well, I guess that's all for now, Mr. Stanwyck. Thanks again. Say, son?
Yes?
I'm glad you called back, because I didn't know where to reach you. I've been thinking about your Bronze Star. I want to make a deal with you.
Oh?
Well, you ought to pick it up. What I'm thinking is this. You pick the Bronze Star up and send it out to us. We'll admire it and hold it for you, and someday when you want it, when you have a kid or something, we'll send it back to you.
That's very nice of you. What do you say? If anything happens to us, we'll make sure you get it somehow. We'll leave it with the bank along with my wife's best shoes.
I don't know what to say.
It's a long life, son, and your feelings change about things.
You send the Bronze Star on to us, and we'll take care of it for you.
You're a sweet man, Mr. Stanwyck. I don't understand that California kind of talk.
May I think about it?
Sure. I'm just thinking it might make the whole thing easier for you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Call any time. I bought some more telephone stock last night.
The Nonhegan Inn. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is Mr. Alan Stanwyck.
Hello, Mr. Stanwyck. Nice to hear your voice, sir.
Teenage girls looking into the racket club playroom. Apparently Fletch was not what they were looking for. I'm calling myself because it's Saturday and I just decided I might come out next weekend.
Oh?
Why does that surprise you?
Well, sorry, sir, I didn't mean to sound surprised. It's just that we look forward to seeing you every 6 weeks or so, and you were here just 2 weeks ago.
I may change my mind about coming.
It will be perfectly all right if you do, sir. We'll keep the suite for you until we're sure you're not coming.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye, Mr. Stanwyck.
Swartout Nevada Realty Company.
Jim Swartout, please.
I'm sorry, sir. Mr. Swartout is out with a client.
When do you expect him?
Well, sir, it is Saturday afternoon.
I see.
May I have him call you after he calls in?
No, thanks. He'll be in the office Monday?
Yes, sir.
I'll get him then.
Chapter 15. Still in tennis whites, Fletch cruised slowly down Vizard Road. The telephone directory had said the number was 12355. It was a pleasant Spanish-styled stucco house set back on a cool lawn. In the driveway was a blue Cadillac Coupe de Ville. Fletch parked in the street. Going toward the house, he smelled and saw smoke, so he went around to the back. Inside the pool enclosure was a fat, balding man in Bermuda shorts contemplating a lighted hibachi. Beside him on a flagstone was a large gin and tonic.
Bert?
The man looked up, ready to be pleased, ready to greet someone, to be glad. Instead, he looked slightly hesitant at someone he had never seen before.
John Zalamarinero, Fletch said.
Oh, yes.
Bert Eberhardt put out his hand.
I'm only in town for the day. Just had lunch with Joan Collins and her father at the Rackets Club.
Oh, yes.
I asked for you. Joan said you lived here at the beach and I should pop in to say hello on the way back to the hotel.
Oh, yes.
I haven't seen you since Joan's wedding. You were best man.
John!
Bert Eberhardt said with a burst of synthetic recognition. He shook hands again.
By God, it's good to see you again. How have you been keeping yourself?
Furniture business, Montana.
That's terrific. You look so young. You say you just had lunch with Joan and her dad?
The grilled cheese special.
Jesus. John Collins and his grilled cheese sandwich. A billionaire, practically, and he gives you a grilled cheese sandwich. I'd hate to see what he'd eat if he were poor.
I know what you mean, fella. I've had plenty of his grilled cheese sandwiches. At least he could buy you a steak. With his money, he's afraid of putting on a pound.
As if anybody cares. Everybody's too busy weighing John's wallet to care what he looks like.
You look prosperous enough yourself.
Now, no cracks, boy.
What can I get you to drink? A gin and tonic?
That would be fine.
It's right here, right here.
A bar was in the shade against the house.
Never be more than 10 feet away from your next drink, I always say.
And he looked it.
We had great fun at the wedding together, you and I, Fletch said.
I guess you don't remember.
God, I was bombed out of my mind. I don't remember anything. For all I know, I was the one who got married that day. What'd you say your last name is again?
Zalamarinero.
That's right, that's right. An Irish boy.
Welsh, actually.
I remember now. We did have fun. Wasn't that a beautiful wedding? Oh, God, did we have fun. I remember you. You went right into the pool with your hat on.
I did?
You did, you certainly did. You walked right up to the pool with your hat on and kept right on walking. Splash! Any man who can do a thing like that can't be all bad.
I don't remember.
I wasn't the only one putting them down that day, my boy. Here's to your health. Oh, God, it's hot. Why people live in this climate, I'll never know. We all rush to California because of the beautiful climate and then spend the rest of our lives indoors hugging an air conditioner. Come sit by the hibachi. We're having a few people over later.
Fletch sat in the shade of an umbrella and watched Bert fiddle with the hibachi between gulps of his drink.
The trick to a good charcoal steak is to start the fire plenty early, 2 or 3 hours ahead of time. Our ancestors, you know, used to have the fire going all the time. Of course, they weren't paying what we are for charcoal. Then, when they wanted to use the fire, it would be right there, ready, and they could control it. You can't control a new fire as well. Golly, I'm awful glad you stopped by, John. You should stay for supper.
No, thanks. I really can't.
Oh, I mean you should. Anybody who has lunch with John Collins needs a steak supper and a battle ribbon.
My plane leaves in a couple of hours.
Then you should have another drink. I always believe in being at least as high as the plane. That way, if it falls down, you still have a chance.
How's Alan?
Oh, he's terrific. Beautiful. He looks like you. Not an inch of fat on his body. Great shape, great shape. Just watching him makes me tired.
I think you said at the wedding you and he were great friends at school.
Colgate, ta-ra! I've been living off him ever since.
What do you mean?
Almost ever since. I had a few lean years before he got married.
I had to work for a living. Want another drink? I've got all his insurance accounts. His life insurance, house, cars, inland marine, the Collins Company. That's why I never disagree with John Collins, despite the grilled cheese sandwiches. After all, I got my future drinking to consider.
Jones said Allen's life is insured for $3 million.
You better believe it.
It's true?
Absolutely true. That guy's worth a lot more dead than alive. Except to me. I get the premiums commission. Every night I pray for him. If he dies, I die. I'd even have to go back to work. Well, Jesus, think of it. Some damn-ass mechanic forgets to tighten a screw on some damn-ass airplane in Idaho this weekend, and my life is over. I hate airplanes. I won't even look at any. Put Raquel Welch on one wing stark naked and Ursula Andress on the other wing and put the airplane right in front of me, and I wouldn't even look in its direction. I'm like Al's mother. He flies and I worry. Probably I'll die of worrying, and he'll fly a loop-de-loop over my grave.
How did you know each other in school?
Oh, he was beautiful. We were roommates as freshmen. He had boxed golden gloves. He was very serious. Work, work, work all the time. You'd think he had a little clock wound up inside him. And if he didn't keep time to it, he'd choke or something. I wanted to get into the fraternity, and he didn't. I mean, he didn't care. He went home most weekends to the ribald town Nonhegan, Pennsylvania. Jesus, what a boring town. I went home with him one weekend. On Saturday night, for excitement, we went downtown and watched the bus stop. I said, Jesus, Al, you're always so serious. College has more to it than just work, work, work. I wanted to get him to apply to the fraternity with me. I thought I'd have a better chance. They turned me down and made an offer to him. He hadn't even applied. The most crushing blow of my life. I thought I'd never get over it. I mean, how the hell can kids 17, 18 years old make decisions like that about someone else after knowing him only a few months? I mean, turning me down? In a few months, this bunch of jerks decided Al was all beautiful and good and I was a shit. And Al didn't even spend the weekends on campus. I rushed the fraternity, and the fraternity rushed Al. Jesus, I wept. Al accepted on condition they accept me, too. His roommate. Jesus, I'll never forget that. The sweetest thing anybody ever did for me. But how did he have the balls to do it? It meant so much, and he stood back cool as a cucumber at 18 and bargained with this bunch of brass monkeys. I thought he'd never carry it off. He did. They accepted us both. They wanted him so bad. And he never did a damn thing for the fraternity except honor it by living there. He still went home on the weekends. I stayed at the fraternity weekends. Jesus, we had some beautiful times. I'll never forget that.
I don't understand. What was so great about Alan Stanwyck?
What's so great about Alan Stanwyck? He's 33 now, and he's running one of the biggest corporations in the world.
Yeah?
Yeah. I know what you're going to say. You're going to say he married Collins Aviation. He's also brilliant, and he's worked like a son of a bitch. I'm proud to live off him.
Sorry. Believe me, the Collins family wanted him, needed him more than he needed them.
I think if it were a toss-up as to whether he saved Alan or Joan, old John Collins would rescue Alan and send his own daughter to the wolves. Alan would be running Collins Aviation today whether he married Joan Collins or not.
You really think so?
I really do. No question about it. You don't know how able this guy is. Corporations should trip over themselves to get Alan, just like the fraternities did. That guy's got everything.
You're a hero worshiper.
Yes, and Alan Stanwyck is my hero.
Do you actually see much of him?
No, not really. We're interested in different things. He's flying, playing tennis, squash, sailing. I'm interested in drinking. He works hard at his business, but he's still very serious about everything. He's incapable of sitting down and having a casual drink as you and I are doing right now. I mean, you know, we're just talking. You're not trying to learn something. I'm not trying to learn something. We're just shooting the breeze. He has to use every moment for some purpose or other. Also, I don't think Joan is too fond of my wife. I'm not either, of course, the little darling. Jesus, you haven't met my wife. With a little luck, you won't. What can I give you to run away with her?
So, Bert, you don't really know an awful lot about what Al's doing or thinking these days.
Well, I never have. No one ever has. That guy plays awfully close to the chest. He could be dying of cancer and he wouldn't tell you.
Funny you should say that.
He wouldn't tell his best friend his pants were on fire.
I thought Joan was very subdued at lunch.
Well, let me put it this way.
You're a friend of Jones, and I'm a friend of Al's, right?
Fletch said, right.
So you see things from her side. Well, I see things from his side.
Right.
He didn't just marry the girl of his dreams. He married a corporation. He married a business, an omnipresent father-in-law, a board of directors, a staff of servants, a rackets club, Christ knows what else. If the average wife is an anchor, that guy is tied to a whole continent.
Jones said something about their buying a ranch in Nevada.
Yes, Al's told me all about it. I'm going to take over the insurance for it when the deal goes through, sometime in a couple of weeks. $15 million worth of cows.
Lucky you.
All these years I've been worrying about Al's dying. Now I have to worry about cows dying. At least, cows don't fly airplanes. Maybe now I should worry about Al's dying of hoof and mouth disease.
Insuring a Nevada ranch seems a little out of your line.
Al's been very good to me. I'm supposed to be in touch with the real estate broker out there in a couple of weeks. I forget his name. I've got it written down somewhere inside.
Jim Swarthout?
Yeah, that's the name. You know him?
Sure, nice man.
Hope he knows more about insuring cows than I do. I need all the help I can get.
I guess the ranch will give them a chance to get away together. I mean Joan and Alan.
No, it's just more corporation. It's her idea, you know, the ranch.
It is?
Yeah, Al couldn't care less about it. He knows less about cows than I do, and all I know is that a cow is a square with legs sticking out at the corners. He doesn't want the damn place. Rancho costo mucho.
I thought it was his idea.
Negative.
Then why is Joan so subdued?
What do you mean?
Well, maybe I'm wrong, but I thought she acted sort of sad over lunch.
She's worse than he is. Serious, serious, serious. Have you ever noticed it before? You'd think with all that money they'd smile once in a while.
It's almost as if they think smiling costs money. Sorry I didn't get to meet their daughter, Julie.
Little brat.
Little brat?
Jesus, I wish she had a sister so I could beat one of them to death with the other one. Have another drink?
Bert, no thanks. I've got to go get on that airplane.
Going back tonight, huh?
Just have time to get to the hotel, change, and get to the airport.
Pity you can't stay and meet my wife. Maybe you'd want to take her with you.
Nice talking with you, Bert.
God, she's awful. Don't make it such a long time again, John. Any time you're in town, drop by.
I will, Bert. I will. Chapter 16. The fuzz, the fuzz, the fuzz. Two screwdrivers, a grilled cheese sandwich, three gin and tonics taken in fast succession. Lying on the beach felt good to Fletch. The sand cooling down in the setting sun had enough warmth to it to permeate his skin, his muscles, his bones. The nearly horizontal rays of the sun were crossed laterally over his body by a twilight breeze. Unabashedly, he slept. It was Sando who shook him, saying,
"The fuzz! Stash anything you've got, a bust!"
Darkness. The bubble lights of the police cars rotated over the seawall. Silence. Forms carrying riot sticks were ambling down the beach. The people on the beach who were able to move were moving as fast as they could without losing a sense of smoothness, trying not to appear as if they were hurrying away. Some were walking into the ocean. A few went to the edge of the water and strolled one way or the other along it, their profiles on the moonlit surface of the water. The foxes had come into the chicken yard. Fat Sam came to the front of his lean-to and sat cross-legged on the sand. Gummy Montgomery remained propped on his elbows. Fletch did not get up. Nowhere could he see Bobby's little form. The police passed to Fletch's right and left. There were seven of them. They wore riot helmets with the visors pulled down. Chief Cummings, a tall man with heavy shoulders, was with them. They stood in an imperfect circle around Montgomery. The chief stuck his riot stick into Gummy's stomach and leaned on it gently.
"Jesus Christ, why me? Why always me?"
"Your papa's worried about you."
"Tell him to go fuck off."
"Let's go, Gummy."
The chief leaned harder on his riot stick stuck in Gummy's stomach.
"I don't have anything. Jesus Christ, I'm clean."
The stick was pressed almost to his backbone.
"Harassment!"
Gummy tried to hit the stick away with the side of his forearm, but only succeeded in hurting both his forearm and his stomach.
Harassment? Big word for an 18-year-old.
I'm 17. Leave me alone.
Another policeman, a short, stocky man, suddenly pounced on Gummy, banging his ear with the back of his hand, his fist closed. He began to swing at his head again from the other side. Gummy scrambled to his feet to escape more blows. Fletch, having given the matter some thought, went behind the stooping, off-balance policeman and pushed him over. The policeman's head plowed into the sand where Gummy had been lying. A third policeman, in surprise, turned to swing his riot stick at Fletch. With full force, Fletch belted the policeman in the stomach. A fourth policeman, a big man, in a gesture of bravado, ripped off his helmet and charged at Fletch bare-fisted. Fletch punched him twice in the face, once in the eye, once on the nose. Fletch heard a crack, saw a flash of light, felt his knees pointing toward the sand. He said, "Shit." His head was in Bobby's lap. There were true stars in the sky. "Jesus," he said. The beach was quiet.
"Does it hurt?"
He said, "Jesus.
Sando came and got me. I thought they'd killed you."
"Oh, my God, it hurts."
"He said you belted a policeman."
"Two of them," Fletch said. "Three of them.
I'm still on the beach." "What can I do to help you?" Bobby asked.
"Shoot me."
"I haven't got any stuff."
Fletch hadn't meant that. He decided to remain misunderstood.
"Why am I still at the beach?" "You thought you'd be in outer space?"
"I thought I'd be in jail."
"You're all right. They're gone."
"Why didn't they arrest me?"
"I'm glad they didn't. I expected them to arrest me. I belted three policemen."
"They would have thrown away the key." Sando stood over them, his shoulders looking bony in the moonlight. He was eating a hot dog.
"Hey, man, how you doing?"
"What happened?" Fletch asked.
"They arrested Gummy again."
"Did they arrest anyone else?"
"No."
"Why didn't they arrest me?"
"They started to," Sando said. "A couple of the apes began to drag you by your ankles."
"What happened?"
"The chief said to leave you there. I guess dragging you over the seawall would have been too much work for his precious bastards."
"Christ, they didn't arrest me. How long have they been gone?"
"I don't know, half an hour."
Bobby said,
"What can I do for you? Should we go back to the pad?"
"You go. I can't move."
"I'll help you," Sando said.
"No, I want to stay here."
"It's Saturday night," Bobby said. "I should be busy."
She was wearing white shorts, a halter, and sandals. "You go get busy," Fletch said. "I'll be all right."
"Are you sure? I mean, it is Saturday night."
"I'll be all right."
"It's going to be a long night," Sando said. "Fat Sam is fresh out."
Pain, anxiety twinged Bobby's face. She had built a big need. "Are you sure?" Fletch said.
"Not even aspirin."
Fletch said, "Christ."
"I'll go work up a couple of tricks anyway."
Bobby's voice shook.
"It's Saturday night and there's always tomorrow."
"Yeah," Sando said. "Sunday."
After Bobby left, Sando sat silently for a while beside Fletch, saying nothing. Then Sando left. Fletch built himself a back and headrest in the sand. He was higher on the beach than Fat Sam's lean-to and could see all sides of it. It was a half moon. No one could enter or leave the lean-to without Fletch's seeing him. The inside of his head felt separated from the outside. Each time he moved or thought of moving his head, the mobile parts hit the stable parts and caused pain. There was some blood in his hair. Grains of sand had stuck to the blood. During the long night, the blood, hair, and sand stiffened into a fairly usable abrasive. After 2.5 hours, Fletch gently lifted himself up, walked 30 paces, lowered himself to his knees, and threw up. Then he walked back to his sand bed. There was no light in Fat Sam's lean-to. Someone was walking from the seawall. Fletch said, "Creasy."
"Hey."
Creasy changed direction slightly and stood over Fletch.
Christ, man, I'm hanging.
Creasy was dressed in blue jean shorts, shirtless, shoeless. He was carrying nothing. Clearly, he was carrying nothing. His hands jerked spasmodically. His eyes moved restlessly. It was true what he had said. He was hanging hellfire.
Is it true, Fat Sam Clean?
Yeah. Creasy said,
I met Bobby. Jesus Christ.
You can always try, Fletch said. Wake the bastard up. Creasy exhaled deeply.
I've got to. No other way. I've got to see the doctor.
Fletch watched him walk down to the lean-to, bend in the moonlight, walk into the shadow. He heard the voices, one desperate, sharp-edged, the other understanding, conciliatory, cool. Creasy walked back up to Fletch.
Jesus, he said, nothing. Nothing at all.
I know.
Jesus.
Creasy's shoulders were shaking visibly, shivering.
Fat Sam said you got fucked by the fuzz. Bobby said so too.
I was cooled.
Can't you move?
Don't want to.
Fucking fuzz.
They arrested Gummy again.
Fucking fuzz.
Creasy began to take deep breaths. Maybe there was a high to be had in hyperventilation, a relaxation. His stomach went in and his chest filled like a balloon, then collapsed. Again and again. In the moonlight, his eyes were bright. Fletch said,
Sorry, man. You got any?
All used.
Bobby?
You know she has nothing.
I know she has nothing. She doesn't store. She uses. Always uses.
What did Fat Sam say?
He said he had nothing. Nothing, nothing.
When will the candy man come?
He said he'd be back in business tomorrow.
What time tomorrow?
Tomorrow morning, 10, 11.
Fletch said, You'll live. Creasy said,
Yeah.
He went back up the beach and over the seawall. Fletch had had concussions before, and he had suffered shock before, but he had spent nights on the beach before. He dreaded the hours before sunrise. They came. He remained on the beach, overviewing Vatsyayana's lean-to. He forced himself to remain awake. The dew came. His jeans, his shirt became heavily wet. Even the inside of his nose became wet. He was horribly cold. He shivered violently, continuously. Staying awake was then no problem. He thought of Alan Stanwix wanting to die in a few days. His wife, his daughter, his mansion. It was possible, but Fletch had not yet proved it. He had not yet checked everything, not all the way. He had a good sense of the man, but not yet a complete sense of the man. He tried not to speculate. He went over in his mind again and again what he would say into his tape recorder next time, what he knew, what he had checked absolutely. He reviewed all the things he did not know yet, all the facts that he had not checked absolutely. There were many such facts. He reviewed his sources. There were not many fresh sources left. He counted the days, four, really, only four, he had left. Sometime he would have to sleep. He promised himself sleep. Sometime. Light came into the sky. Throughout the night, with the exception of Creasy, who was clearly carrying nothing, no one approached Vatsyayana's lean-to. Fat Sam did not leave the lean-to. By 8:45, Fletch was sweating in the sun.